From National Public Radio in New York, this is Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow.
Okay, Houston, we've had a problem here.
This is Houston. Say again, please.
Houston, we've had a problem.
30 years ago last night, that alarming message delivered in the calm and collected voices of two seasoned astronauts would make space exploration history. The world would wait with bated breath to see if the crew of Apollo 13 would make it safely back to Earth. But at NASA Mission Control, they weren't just waiting. A team worked around the clock to find a way to bring the astronauts home. Coming up, the man that led that team, Gene Kranz, former NASA flight director, joins us to talk about Apollo 13 and NASA missions past, present, and future. A man to whom failure is not an option. Stay with us.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. The U.S. stock market continues to drop. Investors are worried about inflation and whether the Federal Reserve will move to increase interest rates to hold down inflationary pressure. The NASDAQ Composite Index is down more than 200 points, or very nearly 7%. For the whole year, the NASDAQ is off 32%. The Dow Jones Industrial Average is down more than 500 points, or about 4.5%. The Justice Department is asking a federal appeals court to order the U.S. relatives of Cuban boy Elian Gonzalez to surrender him to his father's care. The relatives have refused to give the boy up, even though Elian's father, Juan Miguel Gonzalez, has agreed to stay in the United States until all court proceedings are finished. The Commissioner of the Immigration and Naturalization Service, Doris Meissner, says the government still wants a peaceful resolution.
We have done everything that we can to help to create the conditions where it can be solved in a cooperative manner. Unfortunately, the Miami relatives have now lost a major opportunity for that to happen.
Meissner spoke to NBC, but the U.S. relatives are resistant. The family's attorney, Spencer Eig, says the relatives will obey the law, but they won't help the government carry out its work.
There is no law that says that my clients must be the agents to deport Elian Gonzalez. They are Elian's loving relatives. They will take care of him. They will love him. But they themselves will not deport him.
The U.S. relatives have filed a new court challenge. They're now asking a federal court to prevent Elian's return to Cuba until the United States can certify that Cuba keeps the United Nations Declaration on Human Rights. Chinese President Jiang Zemin continues his visit to Israel and the Palestinian-controlled areas. Today, he inspected a desert hothouse of fruit grown with salty water. NPR's Linda Gradstein reports.
Today, Jiang took a break from the controversy surrounding Israel's planned sale of a spy aircraft to China. He listened to farmers explain new techniques of desert agriculture that China could use to make its deserts bloom. He also heard about an Israeli-Jordanian-Palestinian joint project to eradicate flies by letting females mate with infertile males. Jiang's trip so far has been dominated by the planned Israeli sale of Falcon Raider to China that would let it track troop movements for 250 miles. The United States is pressuring Israel to cancel the deal, saying the radar could be used against Taiwan. Today, Israel's deputy defense minister said Israel is committed by contract to selling at least one plane equipped with the sophisticated radar system. Linda Gradstein, NPR News, Jerusalem.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down 497 points at 10,426. Trading is exceedingly heavy. The NASDAQ is down nearly 300 points at 3,881. This is NPR. In NPR's business update, the heavy metal rock group Metallica is charging copyright infringement and racketeering in a lawsuit against an internet company that lets users download music for free. NPR's Elaine Corey reports from San Francisco.
Technology from the Bay Area company Napster lets users share copyrighted music that's stored on their computer hard drives in a digital format called MP3. Metallica drummer Lars Ulrich stated he was sickened to know that the band's music was being traded like a commodity rather than art. Besides Napster, Metallica also sued three universities for failing to block access to the Napster website. The suit alleges that Indiana University, Yale, and the University of Southern California allowed illegal activity to flourish in violation of federal racketeering law. Napster is also being sued for copyright infringement by the Recording Industry Association of America. A company spokesperson said Napster is ready to defend its actions in court. Elaine Corey, NPR News, San Francisco.
Drug maker American Home Products is proceeding with a settlement with users of the diet drug combination Fen-Phen. Nearly 6 million people used Fen-Phen before it was pulled from the market 3 years ago. It's been linked to serious heart problems. The company says 1% of the users have decided to participate in the $4 billion settlement. A judge must still approve the deal. The government reports consumers paid more in inflation last month. The Labor Department says the Consumer Price Index jumped 0.7% in March. It's the largest monthly increase in nearly a year, and it was a lot larger than analysts were looking for. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR News, in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Morgan Stanley Dean Witter. We measure success one investor at a time. On the web at msdw.com.
This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatto. The call for help came late in the evening, 10:55 p.m. Eastern Time, April 13, 1970. Millions of us were wrapped up in our plans for the holiday seasons of Passover and Easter. At Cape Canaveral, flight engineers and mission controllers were settling in for the night, expecting an uneventful, some would call it almost routine, mission to the moon, if there could be such a thing. Then calmly and quietly, almost lost amid the busy chatter of ground controllers, came the voices of two of the astronauts aboard Apollo 13, Jack Swigert and Jim Lovell.
Flight, Tommy.
Okay, we've got a problem here.
What's the matter with the data you have?
The current looks normal.
Okay.
We've got more than a problem.
Okay, listen, you guys. We've lost fuel cell 1 and 2 pressure.
We lost O2 tank 2 pressure.
You want to look at it?
And temperature.
Yeah, problem.
Okay.
Roger. Stand by. They got a problem.
See a hardware.
Main B, bus undervolt.
Roger. Main B, undervolt. Or, ECOM?
Negative flight.
O2 tank 2 pressure?
I believe the crew reported.
We got a main B undervolt.
Okay, flight. We've got some instrumentation flights. Let me add them up.
Roger.
Okay, stand by. 13, we're looking at it.
NASA's engineers, technicians, and flight controllers went into overdrive trying to figure out what had happened, what might happen, and how to get the crew of Apollo 13, its three astronauts, home alive. Amid the controlled chaos, the flight director gave a pep talk to his crew.
Okay, now let's everybody keep cool. We got the LEM still attached. The LEM spacecraft's good, so if we need to get back home, we got a LEM to do a good portion of it with. Okay, let's make sure that we don't do anything that's going to blow our CSM electrical power with the batteries or that will cause us to lose the main or the fuel cell number 2. Okay, we want to keep the O2 and that kind of stuff working. We'd like to have RCS, but we got the command module system, so we're in good shape if we need to get home. Let's solve the problem, but let's not make it any worse by guessing.
The calm, controlling, in-charge voice of Apollo Flight Director Gene Kranz, whose team of engineers and technicians drew upon every bit of knowledge they had ever picked up, every instinct they had ever had, every bit of flight experience to cobble together a solution that would allow the astronauts to stretch their dwindling supply of oxygen and make it safely back to Earth. Joining me this hour is Gene Kranz. He was the flight director on duty when the first men landed on the moon in Apollo 11. He was on duty when the last group of men left the moon on Apollo 17, and he's written a book about those days. So we'll be talking this hour about the history of human spaceflight at NASA, where it's going today, how NASA has changed over the years, and how Gene Kranz looks at the current state that NASA is in. Hopefully he'll give us his opinions. And if you'd like to put in 2 cents of your own, well, you're more than welcome to. Give us a call. Our number is 1-800-989-8255. 1-800-989-TALK, And if you want more information about what we're talking about this hour, as always, you're invited to surf over to our website at sciencefriday.com, where you'll find links to all of our topics. Now, let me fully introduce my guest. Gene Kranz is a former flight director at NASA's Mission Control and also the director of mission operations for NASA. His new book, Failure is Not an Option, Mission Control from Mercury to Apollo 13 and Beyond, has just been published by Simon & Schuster. He joins us from Fort Lauderdale, Florida. Welcome to the program.
Ira, I'd like to thank you, National Public Radio, and your listeners for the opportunity to speak on my Men and Women of Mission Control.
What did you think of that little piece of tape we played there?
It still gives me the shivers. You know, it's amazing. You listen to yourself decades later and say, boy, we sure had it together that day. You know, a lot of times you look back and say, if we had to do it over again, could we do it? And then I think a bit and say, yeah, I think we could.
What made you, what were the ingredients that allowed you to do it when you had to do it? You just, as you say, failure is not an option.
Ira, the real tools of mission control are not the technologies, it isn't our displays. It's really the people coupled with leadership, trust, teamwork, and values. Leadership to build the momentum and point the direction, trust that's going to allow us to make the seconds count. Values that bring this team together as the mission gets tougher, and teamwork, which is going to assure victory.
And how important is your role, or was your role, as a leader in keeping everybody together? It looks like there could have been a point where people were getting upset. I'm trying to be euphemistic about this.
No, Ira, the flight director is where the buck stops. The flight director's job description is only one sentence long. The flight director may take any action necessary for crew safety and mission success. During the course of a mission, there is no higher authority. And on the lunar missions, we carried four teams of flight controllers, each with their flight director. One of these teams was always designated as a crisis team. So if we got into trouble, it was up to the crisis team to find some way to get out of the shifting sequence and start working the problem while the other three remaining teams kept at the job of keeping the spacecraft going as best we could.
You talk about the emotional ending of the Apollo program, ending in number 17, how you felt, how other people felt. You must drive by one of those three Saturn V's that lie on the ground almost every week, I would imagine.
Yes.
And I imagine you can't drive by that without having some feelings about it.
No, I think that the unfortunate thing is we had all the flight hardware ready to go. We had the Saturns, we had the lunar modules, we had the command and service modules. The teams were probably at their peak of effectiveness at this phase in the program. And for some reason, our country just decided we've had enough, it's time to quit. And I think this was probably one of the toughest times of my entire life because we had fought so hard. Mm. To win the Battle of the Cold War and get into a position of leadership in space, we had a lot of exploring yet to do, and all of a sudden, it's over.
Are you familiar with Arthur C. Clarke's famous quote about that?
No, I'm not.
He was asked, he's a great science fiction writer.
Yes.
And he was asked about what was the most amazing part of the race and success in getting to the moon. And he said, the most amazing part is that we could go there and not go back.
I like that. I like that quote. I believe, that's my feeling here today. It's been three decades now.
Yeah.
Since we've been on the surface of the moon, and in space, we've been marching in place since then. It's sort of like the American settlers had stopped at the boundaries of the Mississippi River and refused to cross over and continue to go west. Mm-hmm. I believe there's a need out there to reestablish this explorer spirit within the nation and get moving again.
Do you think NASA still has that spirit?
I believe the young people. I speak to every co-op that comes in down in Houston at Johnson Space Center. I speak to the Zero-G airplane program. I'm a motivational speaker today. And this yearning is still there. And for some reason or other, we seem unable to develop a plan. We've got a good set of goals that mm-hmm. were established for us in the mid-80s. Those goals are as good today as they were then. And it's in a document called Pioneering the Space Frontier. And it establishes the role for our nation in this century. And we seem unable to pick that up, turn it into a plan, and then go out to the American public and the U.S. Congress and say, here it is, here's what we must do.
Why is that, do you think?
Well, there's a lot of reasons, I would say. I break it down to really two. We have not yet established what I would say a true mandate for space. It's not on the national horizon. It's sad to me that no candidate for the presidency really had a platform or even a statement on space. I think that's one. Mm-hmm. I think the second thing is I think the NASA leadership has taken a low profile. I don't know why. I think they might be embarrassed by the current problems they have working with the Russians. But the bottom line is we need leadership from the very top at NASA to get this thing back on track again, and we're not getting it.
Do you think, I was reading, as soon as I saw the title of your book, Failure is Not an Option, I thought that was a message to NASA.
I never thought of it that way, but I'd certainly agree with you, because I think everything is in place. We have the young people, we have the technologies, we have probably the most best-performing economy we have had since the 60s, and yet we still are willing to settle for doing nothing.
Well, you know, one of the hallmarks of the space program President Kennedy is able to set a 10-year goal and have a timeline of doing that. We don't have 10-year goals in anything in this country anymore, do we?
No, that's correct. You know, when President Kennedy made the statement that we choose to go to the moon in this decade and do other things, not because they are easy, but because they're hard. That was a very peculiar choice of words. And I think what he wanted to do was wake Americans up that if we want to survive as a nation, we must continue to go forward. It's not going to be easy. We're going to have to take risks, and it's time to go do it. I would love to see a leader stand up and send that kind of a message to America and Americans today.
Are you going to be running for Congress anytime soon?
I do probably between 50 and 70 public sessions a year, and I would say I talk to between, 60 and maybe even 100,000 people, and I keep driving the same message home. And this book has given me a platform to continue speaking and trying to get this point across. We're ready. The people are ready. The kids are ready. They must have a dream. It's time to get going.
Where would your dream take you? Would your dream take you back to the moon first, or would you go to Mars directly?
That's a tough decision, tough call to make. I would take a look at the technologies that are available to us immediately, and I would find out what is the best test bed, because once we decide to go to Mars, we're talking about a years-type journey.
Right.
I would like to have some way to flight test the elements of that system and sustain an environment of a vacuum and the temperatures, pressures, those kinds of things that you must prove the design works before we send men out there. So I might consider either going to the moon or going into an extremely high, long-duration orbit.
Let me ask you a question about that that night of Apollo 13, and I was one of these people who remember exactly where they were when this happened. you know, the movie's been made. There's a great movie about the documenting it, but when you listen to the tapes, you actually hear two people saying, Houston, we've had a problem. Not we have a problem. Houston, we've had a problem. And you hear Schweigert and then Lovell saying, is that correct? Am I hearing
it
correctly?
Yes, you're hearing it exactly right. And Schweigert was sitting at the main display panel up in the command and service module. He is the guy who had just initiated the cryogenic stir, and he had turned the heaters on. So he was the guy in place, and he made the first report. Lovell was in the process of continuing to close out the spacecraft. So I'm sure that what he did is he came in and looked to see what the Swigert might have been doing, what was going on, and he made the same call.
Well, it almost sounded like they were having trouble getting anybody's attention there.
No, it was not difficult getting the attention. You know, when a crewman calls down from a spacecraft, we got a problem. They don't have to raise their tone of voice, but you could feel the heart rates in mission control pick up. Mm-hmm. By the time that we got Lovell's call, which is just about a couple seconds after Swigert's, I had already had three controllers report problems to me. I had a computer restart, I had a main bus undervolt, and something had caused the antenna switch beam width. So as soon as I got that call, I was trying to say, what problem is Lovell talking about?
Right.
So it was this whole thing was just packed into about the first 10 to 15 seconds, and then the next thing we see is the crew take control of the spacecraft manually because we're starting to see a lot of motions, and he has to control it so he can keep his antennas oriented back towards Earth.
So you knew something serious was happening by then.
Yes, oh yeah. Yeah, there's no question about it, but my initial thought was that we had had just another electrical glitch, and we'd be back on track and solve the problem very rapidly and get going again, because we had had two significant electrical glitches earlier in the shift. We had one from the communications antenna system, and we had another one from the oxygen tank, too.
Mm-hmm.
It took me about 5 minutes before I recognized that, hey, this isn't an electrical problem. It's not something that's going to be solved easy. It isn't something that's going away. Because one of my controllers came to me and said, hey, we had a whole bunch of valves that closed on us.
Yeah.
And I had a similar experience back in Apollo 9 when a shock closed many of the propulsion valves in the spacecraft.
All right, we're going to take a quick break and come back and talk lots more with Gene Kranz and your opportunity to talk with him, so don't go away. We'll be right back. This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from National Public Radio. Welcome back to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking this hour about the history of human spaceflight with Gene Kranz, former flight director at NASA's Mission Control. He's author of Failure is Not an Option, Mission Control from Mercury to Apollo 13 and Beyond, published by Simon & Schuster. And it's a great read if you're a space buff and if you just want to know what it was like. It's hard to believe. It's 30 years ago. Gene, this feels like yesterday, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. The nice thing about writing the book was I would get teams of controllers, each one of the functional disciplines, and then I'd pull entire teams together. And we'd just start a general bull session about that mission or life in general or what was going on back in the division. And that got the juices flowing, and it was a marvelous time for me. It was very enjoyable, not only for myself, but for every controller who participated in the writing.
How did your traditional white vest come about?
I was a Air Force fighter pilot, and my wife used to make the silk scarves for the pilots in the squadron.
Uh-huh.
When time came along for me to fly my first mission as flight director, I was casting around for some way to bring the team together, to start building this team chemistry we would need not only for that mission, but for everyone from then on. The first three flight directors selected the color red, white, and blue. Mike, team color was white. So I was talking this over one evening with my wife at the dinner table, and she said, gee, why don't I make him white vest? Why don't you use that as basically the insignia for your mission control team? And you never tell your wife that's a silly idea. But I thought, gee, Marta, why don't you go ahead and do that? So she made one. I brought it into the mission control center inside out. Nobody saw me come on. And when it came time to start the shift, I was going around polling my controllers. I stood up, put the vest on, and a controller next to me looked and he saw this crazy guy in the white vest, and he says, you know, if people start seeing you, they're going to haul you away and they're going to put me in charge. And pretty soon the mission control TV zoomed in and I was on every television throughout all of mission control. The team liked it, and if I was very happy with the team's performance, Marta would make me a celebration vest for the final shift of the mission. And this was splashy and loud and noisy, but always had a white background to it.
Interesting. That's a great story. Let's go to the phones. Len in Dallas. Hi, Len.
Hi, Ira. Gene, this I worked with you at the Mission Control Center when we were doing the mission control upgrades back in the early 80s. And the last time I saw you was at your retirement party, as a matter of fact. And I wanted to call and say hi. And also to tell folks that that you really are a true American hero. And, you know, if we could recycle everything on this planet, if we could recycle sweat, it's still a finite resource. And, you know, we're going to eventually have to get off the planet. And I think you're the leader to spread the message. And we've got the technology, and I'd like to see a lot of people listen to what you've got to say.
Well, Lynn, thanks for calling in, and it's great to hear from you again. You know, I'm going to be up in Dallas for a book signing the 25th, I believe.
Okay, there you have it. Len will be able to get this to shake hands and buy a book at the same time. 1-800-989-8255. Let's go to Robert in Mill Valley, California. Hi, Robert.
Hello.
Hi there.
How are you?
Fine.
Good. My question has to do with the priorities that America has concerning the problems we have here in the country now and how we spend the money. And it is thrilling. It was thrilling to watch these things that happen, men going to the moon. But over the years, I'm wondering about money spent to take care of teachers, steel workers, artists, railroad workers, the American farmer, and I'm wondering what the how they will be helped by going to the moon or going to Mars. That's basically my question.
Okay.
Okay. I think that if you would take a look at the 60s, when we started off in space, we had to create or invent the technologies that we've been living off for the last several decades. The investment in the space as well as into military R&D paid off enormously in establishing the standard of living we as Americans enjoy today. I believe it is essential to give young people a dream, a sense of direction, so that they are always moving forward to be the best that they can be, which means they must take the hard courses in school. They must discipline themselves to perform. I believe space provides an opportunity to give young people a sense of direction. It gives the education system a sense of direction, and it gives American industry a sense of direction. You know, you mentioned about the farmers and the teachers and all of these.
Yeah.
At the time in the Apollo program, we had a great American aircraft and space industry. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, as the space industry went downhill, the Grummans, the North Americans, the McDonald's virtually ceased to exist. These were companies that employed people.
Well, outside
so I believe...
The,
go ahead.
Outside of the military, why don't you give me some specifics as to how it's helped farmers and teachers?
Well, I believe the first thing is in the education system, there were no courses, no classes. In the areas of aerodynamics, astrodynamics, there were no classes associated with computer operations. All of these technical skills had to be brought into America today, and these are the skills that our students are using and producing enormously in improving America's productivity.
Okay, Robert, thanks for calling.
All right, thanks a lot.
All right, 1-800-989-8255 is our number. We're talking with Gene Kranz, author of Failure is Not an Option. How long did it take you to write this book?
It took about 4 years. I started in 1996, and I wrote the entire book myself. I had about 200,000 words, and I had to hire an editor. I couldn't stand to cut back in the text myself, so I hired an editor to help me out.
It's tough being an editor, especially editing your own things.
Yes.
Why not get private industry? Here's my vision. Let me throw this by you and see what you think of it.
Okay.
Why not get a consortium of multimedia companies, maybe the Time Warner AOL consortium that's going to be coming about possibly, and a big companies to sort of fund a mission to the moon, maybe a let's say a a base, a moon base on the moon, where you could build a radio telescope because of all the interference we're having here on Earth. Astronomers would love to have a radio telescope on the opposite side of the moon, the far side of the moon. So then you'd have a real science mission here. Maybe you can get the National Science Foundation to chip in a little bit of that. You could get the Time Warner AOL people to have rights to broadcast from the spacecraft and from the moon, so they would buy exclusive rights like they do to the Super Bowl or something like that. And then you get privately financed this way. Any thoughts about
it? I believe it's long past the time that we truly commercialize many of the space ventures that we have. I believe it's time that we move away from the use of the shuttle and put the crews on board that are exclusively quote-unquote astronauts. I think it's we started off with the teacher in space program with the Crystal McAuliffe.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, we had a disaster there, but that doesn't mean that we should quit. We should get the teachers back into it. I believe we've flown a couple politicians. Why not get a couple editorial writers? Let's put America in the vantage point of looking back down at this Earth, and maybe they can better articulate the reasons for us to take care of it.
Mm-hmm.
But I think you're right on track.
All right. Daniel in Raleigh, North Carolina.
Hi, Gene. It's a great pleasure. I can't tell you how pleased I am. Listen, just real briefly, in response to your previous caller, there's a magazine that NASA puts out called Spinoffs, directly points to the NASA economy spinoff, economic return, Corningware, plexiglass, Teflon, satellites doing weather, Gore-Tex and integrated circuits, computers. The list is virtually endless. So so I certainly am one who supports the use of NASA as sort of a laboratory for economic development. But my question is this: I teach. I'm a flyer. I'm an aircraft mechanic, and I'm a business owner now. And I'm a machinist, and I'm a welder, and I've been teaching in technical education for a long time. And one of the things that occurs to me, and I don't know whether you notice this or not, I don't know what side of the fence you'll be on, but I always get a kick out of the fact that even though I have 7 or 8 graduates who are A&P mechanics who are working at NASA, working at Kennedy, Kennett Canaveral, even though they're all mechanics and they're machinists and they're technicians who don't necessarily all have engineering degrees, the media is exclusively reporting that NASA engineers are fixing the problem. Well, I know for a fact that it's a machinist fixing the problem, or it's a hydraulics guy fixing the problem. And I'm not suggesting that we should or shouldn't be elitist or be proud of people who are highly educated, but there are those of us who are we're the wrench turners who send these machines up. And in my educational background, I've noticed that a lot of engineering students come in and all they want to do is crunch numbers and they want to push computer keys, and they want to do all these wonderful programs, and that's great. But one of the things I noticed about your generation of engineers was that you didn't just talk about things, you did things. You didn't just talk about and have a committee meeting about a carbon dioxide excess in 13. You fixed the problem. And I'm just curious. That's a long preface. I apologize. But by the way, I bought your book as I was waiting
okay,
on hold.
Got it.
I'm wondering what you think about the educational system and how it's focusing more on science and computers and all of those types of things rather than a comprehensive education for engineers that includes the mechanical trades and understanding of materials and things in addition to just being able to crunch numbers.
Okay, let me see if I can give you a brief answer in this. I came through a small aviation college in East St. Louis, Illinois called Parks. And in addition to getting my engineering degree, I also got my aircraft and power plant license. I learned to bend sheet metal, do dope and rags, fabric-covered airplanes, etc. So basically, I believe that the practical experience is incredibly important in understanding how things work and being able very rapidly to move out into a direction. One other thing, in the mission control teams that I had in the 60s, we had many what I'd consider self-taught engineers, people who came up through the ranks of the Air Force who did not have a degree, who were principal contributors. Ed Fendell, one of my supervisors, ran all of my communications and instrumentation control team members. One of our lead instructors was non-degreed, so we had lots of people in the team. who were principal contributors, mm-hmm. but their experience came through the College of Practical Experience.
Mm-hmm. All right, Daniel, thanks for calling. What was your reaction to NASA Administrator Dan Golden said a couple weeks ago that failure of 2 out of 10 missions was acceptable to him?
To me, this is an unacceptable statement. Any failure has to be traced down to a specific set of causes. Now, as you risk more, the potential for failure goes up. So therefore, you have to put controls in place to make that risk acceptable. I believe NASA's current problem, I don't know exactly the situation out of JPL from a standpoint of their organizational structure, etc. But when I left the Johnson Space Center, NASA was in the process of subscribing to many what I'd consider faddish management techniques. We were flattening organizations, we were re-engineering organizations, we were building focus teams, etc. The process of doing that, however, took away a middle management training ground for mid-range managers within the NASA teams that I had at Johnson. And if you don't have a training ground for people to move up into the business of risk and project management, you're eventually going to fall flat in your face.
We're talking with Gene Kranz this hour on Talk of the Nation Science Friday from National Public Radio. I'm Ira Flatow, and we're talking about Gene about his new book, Failure is Not an Option, which is just out, written by Gene, by himself. It's good to see that there's not not one of those as-told-to books. And it's really written well for someone who is not a professional writer. Published by Simon & Schuster, our number 1-800-989-8255 is our number. Let's go to the phones and let's go to David in St. Paul. Hi, David.
Hello, Ira. And Mr. Kranz, it's you can't imagine what kind of honor it is for me to talk to you today. When Apollo 13 was flown, I was 13, as a matter of fact, and I was president of my rocket club in the sixth grade, and I probably should have owned stock in Revell and Monogram models and SS rockets as well. One of the things that you lead in, Ira, you used the word routine, and I think that one of the things that people have to understand, and I think that people in Congress especially have to understand, that spaceflight is not routine, and it won't be probably during the span of the next several lifetimes. It's probably the most unforgiving environment that you can imagine, other than perhaps at the bottom of the ocean. I think those two are probably very comparable as far as the margin for error that allowed. And people like Mr. Kranz are around to bring us to understand that these things are not routine, and that when something goes wrong, people like Mr. Kranz and his crew back in 1970 are there to try to figure out, and luckily they were very successful in figuring out how to get these three astronauts back to Earth safely, even though the nominal mission was not going to be accomplished. And I guess one of the things I was thinking, and I actually have C-SPAN, and I was watching Mr. Golden, I was watching the hearings, the whole concept of smaller, faster, cheaper, when it was announced several years ago, really irritated me. And one of the problems I saw was that if you're going to build something, make something smaller, and you're going to make it faster, generally it should probably end up being more expensive, like it or not. And that has to do with the non-routine nature of spaceflight, the fact that if you design your unmanned program in such a way that 2 out of 10 missions fail, I think that there are going to be some very unfortunate practices that insinuate themselves into the manned space program. And I think that our tolerance of the delays that the Russians have been subjecting us to as far as the space station are a prime example of that. I don't think that the Russians, I think that they've unfortunately forfeited their place on the space station because of the problems they've been having and their apparent inability to solve them.
Let me get a quick. We have to take a break. Let me get a quick reaction from Gene.
Thanks a lot.
Take that break. Yes,
I think Daniel pretty much stated what I would say. I would indicate, however, that you do set up sort of a theme for a package. Better, faster, cheaper is not necessarily a bad set of statements. What you have to do, however, is have a team in place that fully understands the boundaries that they will work to within that guidance. And if it isn't working out that way, stand up and say, hey, I need some relief here.
Do you think the fact that a lot of NASA has been, you know, given over to private practice here has affected the safety of the program?
No, I don't think so. I think that the safety process, you know, this is going to get into longer discussion. I still go back. The real problem that I think we've got in NASA today is the lack of qualified mid-range managers who are capable of looking at something and say, that doesn't sound right, it doesn't smell right, let's go back and look at it one more time.
All right, we're going to take another short break and come back and get lots more of your questions, talk lots more with Gene Kranz, author of Failure is Not an Option, Mission Control from Mercury to Apollo 13 and Beyond. So stay with us. So we'll be right back and finish out the hour. This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from National Public Radio.
Support for National Public Radio comes from this and other National Public Radio stations. Contributors also include the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Kellogg Foundation, helping people help themselves by investing in individuals, their families, and their community, on the web at www.wkkf.org. The Ford Foundation, a resource for people and institutions worldwide. And the Geraldine R. Dodge Foundation for reporting on biological resource issues. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
This is Robert Siegel. Later today, the crusade to reduce the tens of thousands of medical mistakes made in the U.S. every year. Prevention is difficult.
You have a bunch of choices. You make choices all the time when you're delivering care. There's a million choices, things competing for your time, for your attention.
Our second report on medical errors and the day's news later on NPR's All Things Considered.
Welcome back to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. A brief program note. This Monday, it's tax day. Join Juan Williams on Monday's Talk of the Nation for a look at the tax plan proposals of Vice President Al Gore and Texas Governor George W. Bush and how they will affect you. We're talking this hour about Apollo 13 and other manned space missions with Gene Kranz, former flight director at NASA's Mission Control, and author of Failure is Not an Option, Mission Control from Mercury to Apollo 13 and Beyond, published by Simon & Schuster. Our number, 1-800-989-8255. Quick question about your history and your memories of the space program. And this is probably not a fair question, but I'll ask it anyhow because it doesn't have to be accurate. It's a question of your feelings about which do you think was more exciting, the John Glenn flight or the Apollo 11 flight?
From my standpoint, it was John Glenn. It was the first step into the unknown. The risks were incredibly high then. When we launched John Glenn, we had two previous failures of the Atlas rocket. And, you know, when we launched him, we didn't know whether we were going to have our fourth good rocket or our third bad one. John Glenn signed up for the risks of the United States as a cold warrior, and he was going to carry America into space.
Did Alan Shepard feel like he has been slighted? While he was alive, did he feel like he was slighted? Because he was the first person in space.
Yes, he was. He was the first person in space. I don't think he ever felt slighted. I felt, however, that he felt that he had been shafted, I guess is probably the better word for it, because of the inner ear ailment
that
he had that caused him to be removed from flight status, and it wasn't until he went through experimental surgery during the Apollo program that he was able to return to flight status and eventually fly to the moon.
Mm-hmm. And of course, how did he get that golf ball on the moon? We golfers wonder that question.
No, each astronaut, he also had, they had a tool they use actually for digging in, getting the core samples from the lunar surface. So what they did is they fitted a iron head to that he could screw on. Each astronaut is allowed to carry what he calls a PPK, or a personal preference kit.
Yeah.
And he carried those materials in his PPK.
What number iron was it? Golf club?
I don't know, but he claimed that even though he duffed the first one, that the second went for miles and miles and miles.
Story will get longer and longer the more people tell it. You tell an anecdote about your first introduction to Cape Canaveral being in Gordo Cooper's convertible driving 90 miles an hour. But there definitely seem to be tensions in latter days between ground controller teams and the astronauts themselves, were there not?
It varied. The idea of a mission control team was new to the Mercury 7 astronauts. This wasn't the way that we had done it in aircraft flight test. Once the crewman went on board the aircraft, it was either released from a mother aircraft or it had been taken off the ground. The astronaut was almost solely in charge of the mission, the accomplishment of the test objectives, and then bringing it back home, and then he'd debrief. Mission control, with its ability to look into the telemetry in the spacecraft systems, communicate with the crew, essentially look over the shoulder, was a new one. And the mission controllers were generally in their early to the mid-20s, so they really didn't have a lot of experience. And basically, we had to earn our spurs, and we did this through a series of pretty doggone good decisions throughout the Mercury program that started earning their confidence by the time we moved into Gemini.
Let's go to Buffalo, New York. Marcus. Hi, Marcus.
Hello, Ira. Hello, Gene. Very nice program you have there.
Thank you.
Great.
I have a question and I have a comment. Somewhere I overheard a conversation that we no longer have a complete set of prints for a Saturn V-C rocket. Do you know for certain that this is true or that this is false?
Marcus, I'm not absolutely sure, but I have heard this from very reputable people, so I tend to believe that that statement is correct.
Okay, thank you. My comment was about the ongoing perception of a duality between spending money on basic research and whatever else you might want to call it, design and research,
development,
as opposed
research
to social programs and their perceived progress. And my comment is simply that I don't believe that that duality exists. I think that the duality is whether there's enough political will or not. I think we can do both. I think we can do neither. It's just a matter of organization.
Marcus, I agree with you 100% there. It is really what we as Americans decide to do, and I believe that is really focused through leadership. We need leaders to stand up and say, here is what I think America should do in this next century, and here is the plan for the next 10 to 20 years.
So are you and Marcus both saying, from the rumors that you hear, that if we wanted to just go back to the moon and pull out those old plans for the launch vehicle, the booster for Saturn V, we wouldn't be able to find them someplace?
That's my understanding. It's my understanding that much of the design data that was used for the development of the Saturn no longer exists.
Could it be as simple as that? If you wanted to go back to the moon, if you had the blueprints, just build them again and pick up where you left off? Or are we more sophisticated now, or do things so much better than we'd have to start from the ground up?
Ira, I would be concerned more. You know, if somebody'd say, when could we go to Mars? I'd say it'd at least take 20 years, because we would have to create the national infrastructure that existed in the 50s and 60s. Remember, we had a very aggressive aircraft program. We had been producing military airplanes in World War II and Korea. So we had the tooling, the technologies, the engineers, all of those things in place. Right now, Grumman as an entity no longer exists. McDonnell is dissipated to a great extent. North American doesn't produce airplanes, airframes. We only have one huge manufacturer now, and I would get concerned that we would need to build up an infrastructure capable of doing this job before we could get moving again.
Yeah. Let's go to Mark. Mark in Davidson, North Carolina. Hi, Mark.
Hi.
Go ahead.
Well, I saw the movie Apollo 13, and I was wondering if the movie was very much like what really happened or if it was very much exaggerated.
No, Mark, it was. I think the movie was very good job. I was very happy at the way they portrayed the young controllers of Mission Control stepping up and assuming responsibility. I was very happy the way they portrayed the flight directors and their role as in charge, and no equivocation about it. The movie, all the problems that you saw in the movie really happened. There were many more problems in the mission that occurred that we had to solve that they just didn't have time to put into the movie. So I would rate the movie at least an A.
Okay.
Okay, Mark?
Thanks.
Thanks. How close was Ed Harris to you?
Yeah. Well, he was a little bit more hyperactive. you know, you tend to, in Mission Control, you don't have to run around to get people's attention. It's just really the crisp calls out to your controllers. We have to be very disciplined in there. We can't afford to waste much motion. If emotion gets too much into the process, you're going to start making mistakes. We're a very disciplined organization.
Let's go to Dennis in Virginia Beach.
Hi, Gene. It's a pleasure to meet you. I worked at the time for Grumman Aerospace, and we had the full mission simulator up in Bethpage.
Yes, sir.
You know, we did all the. I've always requested by you people to do like a 4-hour run ahead of time, and to see if the actual descent stage on the LEM could actually push the whole command module around the backside of the moon. I don't know, do you remember those times?
Oh, yes, yes, I remember it very well. I spent a lot of time with Tom Kelly and his guys up there. Actually, the lunar module was my favorite spacecraft. I flew more of the lunar modules than any of the other flight directors. My first mission was the unmanned flight test in Apollo 5, which was a pretty good mission there.
Yeah, we did everything. Matter of fact, the consulting pilot was Sam Greenberg, and I remember sitting down and coming up with, you remember the, we made up a bill of lading to North American.
Yes, you did.
All right, and I to this day I still have the copy of the original one without Lou Evans' signature on it.
Yeah, what they did, Ira, was Grumman made up a bill of lading charging North American for bringing their command and service module back home.
Transportation like a tow truck.
Right? That's right. That's exactly right.
But, you know, lost amidst Apollo 13 is Apollo 11, the first landing on the moon. And how exciting that was, and how you were flying, as they say, at the edge of the envelope and bringing that last 100 feet down, wasn't it?
Yes. No, that was probably the toughest 12 minutes of my life, because as we started down to the surface, we had many problems in communications. We had a navigation error that was reported that was halfway to our abort limits. We had a minor electrical problem with the meter on board the spacecraft. We had a variety of computer program alarms. And as a result of a small pressure remaining in the tunnel between the spacecraft at undocking, it shoved us further down it shoved us away from our landing site. So the crew was actually going to land in the Boulder Field. And we don't have a fuel gauge that actually takes and measures the fuel in the lower part of the tank. It's like driving your car and empty. So we actually use a stopwatch, and my controllers would count out 120 seconds, 90, 60. We got down to 30 seconds, and I said, my God, it's going to be close. Well, at the time, the controller was calling out 15 seconds of fuel remaining before a land abort decision was when we heard the crew shutting down the engines.
Hmm. We're talking with Gene Kranz this hour on Talk of the Nation Science Friday from National Public Radio. And that really showed what a good, cool pilot Neil Armstrong was, didn't it?
Yeah, there was no question.
He flew that himself down. No automation there.
No automation. And he brought it all the way down. But I had that sense that he was the right guy from the very first time I met him in Gemini. I watched him in Apollo. I worked with him in developing the landing strategy, and I knew that he was going to take it all the way to the surface if I could get him close enough. And it was my job to get him in the ballpark where he could go ahead and land it.
How could have Apollo 10 have landed the mission beforehand if they, you know, they really wanted to? I can imagine going around the moon and not getting down there must have been one heck of a temptation.
Yeah, it was tough for the entire crew. I'd sure hate to do it also. I think it could have, but I think the risk at this stage of the game would have been higher than we wanted to sign up for. Apollo 10 was sort of the dress rehearsal for the full lunar landing, and therefore on 11 we just had to go the last 50,000 feet.
Mm. Last thoughts, Gene, on where you'd like to see us go in the future and how to get there?
I'd really like to create a crusade within the nation that puts space on the national agenda. I would like to see a reinvigorated NASA, very similar to the Space Task Group that I joined in the early days. I believe we need a new leader in NASA, and I believe it is essential to engage Congress and to get them back into the action where they understand the need to continue moving forward in space.
You don't think that the current administrator is a forceful enough proponent of the space program?
No, I don't believe he's forceful enough proponent, and I also tend to believe that he's too close to the administration and the political involvement with the Russians.
All right. Thank you very much for joining us this hour. Gene Kranz is former flight director at NASA's Mission Control and the author of a really good book, Failure is Not an Option, Mission Control from Mercury to Apollo 13 and Beyond, published by Simon & Schuster. Thanks for taking time out of your busy day to talk with us today.
Great, Ira, and thanks for the people that called in, and thanks for the opportunity to speak on NPR and talk about Mission Control.
Thank you very much. Cal Southworth is our technical director. Our audio engineers are William O'Neill and Rick Stone in New York. Bob Boylan composed our theme music. We had help today from NPR librarians Kim Leske and Alphonse Vinn, and from Pat Alpleson in Fort Lauderdale. If you have comments or questions, write to us at Talk of the Nation Science Friday, WNYC Radio, 1 Center Street, New York, New York, 10007. And if you missed any of the references we make on Science Friday, you're always welcome to surf over to our website at sciencefriday.com. You can also find archived versions of Science Friday going back many, many years. If you miss Science Fridays, you can search through them and listen to them on Real Audio or take them with you on the road on audible.com. Have a great weekend. I'll see you next week. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.
Science Friday is produced by National Public Radio and Samana Productions in association with member station WNYC New York. The views expressed are not necessarily those of NPR, the underwriters, or this broadcast station. For tapes and transcripts, call toll-free 1-877-NPR-TEXT. That's 1-877-NPR-8398.
Support for National Public Radio comes from this and other National Public Radio stations. Contributors also include the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the Henry J. Kaiser Family Foundation for coverage of health, on the web at www.kff.org, and the W. Alton Jones Foundation for a coverage of efforts to reduce threats of nuclear war and proliferation. www.wajones.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
I'm Ira Flatow. Monday is tax day, and if you're like most Americans, you're probably wondering why you pay so much to the IRS. Republican presidential candidate George W. Bush has a plan to do something about that with a tax cut plan that Vice President Gore says is irresponsible. Join Juan Williams on Monday's Talk of the Nation for a look at what the two candidates are proposing and how it will affect you. That's on Talk of the Nation from National Public Radio.